thank you for having me back in Texas. I graduated from Memorial Senior High School, the first graduating class from Memorial, so that tells you how old I am. And before that, I'd gone to Spring Branch, which I understand is some kind of correctional facility or something like that now. But at the time, Spring Branch, of course, was the real high school of note in terms of Texas's fetish for football. We were actually in the state championship game my junior year. We lost. We lost to a Bolger, I believe it was, and a little African-American running back called Warren McVay. That'll date me, too. He went on to the NFL, of course. My memories of Texas are hot summers and spring training where at least one guy usually died from the heat. As a matter of fact, in my senior year, we were going through spring training at Memorial, which was brand new, and so we weren't planning on doing very much in the football leagues of Texas, but we were going to give it a shot. And they passed a rule in the immediate area anyway, Harris County, Bel Air, other schools like that, that you couldn't have spring training anymore in Texas. I don't know if that's still a rule, but it was so hot. So welcome. I welcomed myself last night back to the most air-conditioned city in the world as I almost froze in the Hilton. It is a pleasure to be back, though. I won't say it's a great pleasure because I think you live in one of the worst states in the Union in terms of what we were just talking about, what you just heard these speakers talk about. Rick Perry, I was just in New Hampshire last week working with the Quakers. I've become noted as the Quaker Colonel in Washington. Let me tell you, the Quakers are doing some incredible work. And one of the things they're doing in New Hampshire is they're training New Hampshireites, like you, to go out and attack these candidates. There are 19 candidates in New Hampshire starting this idiocy we call an election process so early that more billions will pour into the coffers of the media and others who just salivate over these prospects. 19. John Bolton is there. John Bolton was Undersecretary of State for International Security Affairs when I was with Powell at the State Department. And let me tell you, John Bolton is a dyed-in-the-wool warmonger. We once had a discussion in his office, me, Jim Kelly, who was Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and the Pacific and an old friend, and John Bolton. And we were trying, Jim and I, to tell John what it would mean to have a war on the Korean Peninsula, because that was what John had called us in to talk about, the potential for using military force to, at that point, this is 2002, prevent Kim Il-sung from having a nuclear weapon. Jim was getting ready to go to Pyongyang and talk to Kang Sak-ju and others about what we thought was a secret enrichment program for uranium. We already had closed down their plutonium program under the agreed framework that Bill Clinton and others had orchestrated before us, but we suspected they were cheating. Well, of course, I could go on and tell you the reason they were probably cheating was because our Congress had reneged on the provisions of the agreed framework to which we were supposed to be living up to include not shipping the heavy fuel oil we had agreed to give them, to include not funding, along with the Europeans, through a group called the Korean Energy Development Organization, the light water reactors we had promised them in order to replace the reactor we were going to freeze and shut down because it produced plutonium that could be made into bombs. And John Bolton's looking across the table at me when I'm the only former military in the room, and I've apprised him of the fact that there'll be about 100,000 people who die in the first 30 days of any war on the Korean Peninsula because of the Passchendaele, Ypres, Verdun-type concentrations of artillery that the North Koreans have on the DMZ. Not up somewhere in the north, but on the DMZ, the demilitarized zone. And those rounds will fall on Seoul, which is a very short distance from the demilitarized zone. That's their capital city. And if you haven't been to Seoul, you haven't seen one of the most incredible cities in the world. The South Koreans do not want to lose that city, and they don't want to lose those people. Well, I even told him a lot of those people would be U.S. citizens because we cannot possibly get them out fast enough in the event of a lightning strike by North Korea. And John looked at me. He tweaked his mustache, and he said, "I don't do war. That's what you do." I'm sorry, John, you do war. As a matter of fact, by the Constitution, civilians do war. The military just carries it out. But this is the kind of blasé attitude that I encountered amongst people called neoconservatives. And I hate that phrase because they haven't got a conservative bone in their bodies. They're radicals. They're Trotskyites. That's what they are. There is no conservatism about them. You know, we conservatives, I'm a conservative, believe essentially that the best that's been thought and said and done in the world ought to be preserved and changed only with great circumspection. That's a definition of conservatism. It comes from Edmund Burke. They aren't conservatives. They're radicals. And they are in incredible pressure right now on some very serious issues in Washington, not least of which is the next big war, which is going to be with Iran. We can talk about that a little bit later if you want to, or I can take it on in question and answer. What I really want to do right now is give you some insight into why what was said before concerns me as an academic of the institutions of government. When Dan quoted from Eisenhower's speech in 1953, which incidentally is my favorite speech of his, where he uses the metaphor a cross of iron, Dan was talking about what Eisenhower realized could happen if the normal tendency of Americans towards violence, yes, I said the normal tendency of Americans towards violence, we are arguably one of the most violent people the world has ever seen, were lashed up with a huge military-industrial congressional complex that fed on that tendency, that predilection, and was structurally geared, institutionally geared, over time to do so. That's what Eisenhower was really concerned about. He called it a most, in transcripted now, we know, conversations from the National Security Council deliberations, he called it spiritual even. He said, as he would say later in his farewell speech, it permeated every state house, every federal office building, indeed every home in America ultimately. It was spiritual even in his words. It affected our very beings. And what we've been talking to up to this point is what that has culminated in. It's culminated in the warfare state, the national security state. There's a book out there by a diplomatic historian, former provost at Iowa, former president of UConn, Michael Hogan. It's called A Cross of Iron, taking that phrase from Eisenhower, who, of course, purloined it from William Jennings Bryan, who in 1896 had the Cross of Gold speech. Nice metaphor for a speechwriter. But the title of Michael's book is from Eisenhower's speech. And I recommend it to you because in that book, with great detail, Michael paints how we went from being what we were prior to World War II to what we inevitably became after World War II, institutionally and otherwise. Well, what do I mean by that? And what does he mean by that? Well, in the time that I have, let's just go over it briefly. The title up here, The Empire of Liberty in Peril, and it was hinted at by earlier speakers, didn't just start in 1945, though it was accelerated mightily by that conflict that preceded that year in the Pacific and in Europe. It began in the very beginning. It began in the most, one would say, I think, strange admixture of, on the one hand, what the Declaration of Independence states in a very radical format, if you think about it, and neoconservatives love the Declaration of Independence. They hate the Constitution. And the Constitution, in a more politically opportunistic way, taking into account all the things that were going on in the country, including slavery, which was probably the second most powerful economic factor in the Republic in the beginning, with manufacturing in the North being the first. Historians are still debating whether slavery was first and manufacturing second, but let's just say slavery was right in there. So they didn't dare do away with it. They wrote in that maybe by 1808, you know, and nobody knew that. Nobody believed that was going to happen. And of course, we all know what transpired all the way up to 1850 and 1860. But in the beginning, there was this strange admixture of people who were like we are today, very much so, and people who really had some pretty good ideas about things like democracy, real democracy, not the farce we have today, freedom, liberty, and so forth. Jefferson even says, uses the phrase for the first time, empire of liberty. Washington agreed with him. Now, here's two people from my home state of Virginia now, 25 years there, I can call it my home state. Here's two people who represent this curious admixture. Jefferson sleeps with a black woman who's his wife's half-sister and produces offspring by that woman. Indisputable now, despite some of my Virginians who want to object to it. And doesn't want to recognize or in a substantial way take care of those children, personifying this strange admixture on the one side, while at the same time writing some of the most incredibly eloquent words the world has heard about freedom and democracy. And Washington owns slaves while he's defending this new republic where everyone's supposed to be equal. Excuse me, if you don't own any land, you're not a man, and so forth, you aren't equal. If you're black, you're certainly not equal. You're 3/5 of a human being. So look at this strange beginning. And then, as was pointed out earlier, we go on and wipe out all the natives in order to consolidate what historians have called for years manifest destiny and so forth. So the seeds are there. I don't mean to say that this all starts in 1945. The seeds are there. I will say that up until 1945, we had done a pretty good job of compromising our two halves, of managing to make some progress, of managing to make something of the better angels of our nature, as Lincoln so eloquently stated. In 1945, we looked around at the world and we said, my God, we're at the top. We had 51% of the gross domestic product of the world. We made 54,000 airplanes in a single year, 7,000 ships in the Navy, 6,000 in the Army. We had 13,000 ships on the high seas. We'd be lucky if we could put 400 there today. We had an incredible armada, and we had to do something about it, and Truman and others knew it, or we were going to contaminate that other half of our republic, that decent half, that moral half, that striving half, that half that wanted to be an empire of liberty and not an empire of territory, slavery, or anything else like that. Well, what did we do? We created three institutions, and we codified them in law, the 1947 National Security Act. The CIA, which we had never had before, the National Security Council, which we had never had before, and we unified the armed forces and put them under a civilian secretary. Those three institutional instruments have been that which fashioned the national security state from Washington's perspective, with a lot of complicity from, over time, Eisenhower's time about 145 million, our time 315 to 20 million, a lot of help from the American people, an apathetic, ignorant American people who watched this happen over the time that it happened and who blessed its happening, at least instinctually, because we had a threat called communism manifested in the Soviet Union, and we thought we had to. Go back and check that January 1961 farewell address of Eisenhower, and you will see how he tries to balance that. He tries to say, we know we have to accept this pernicious influence that's in every state house, every federal office building, even in our homes. We know because of this threat we have to tolerate this. But we should be always constantly aware of the fact that this influence is pernicious, insidious, and if we don't monitor it, if we don't oversee it, it will someday balance and overwhelm that good side and produce only the bad side. And that's exactly what has happened. Go back to July 26, 1947, and Harry Truman is signing the 1947 National Security Act on board his airplane. And George Marshall, probably the most iconic military figure in American history, I'd put him right there with George Washington. George Marshall looks at the president as he's signing the act, and he says, Mr. President, I fear we have militarized the decision-making process. And he was right. Probably no more prescient remark has been made by a military officer in the history of our republic. We have militarized the decision-making process. So when you look at this, as I do, as an academic, from a decision-making format, and you tell your students, what we're going to do this semester in 14 three-hour sessions meeting once a week is examine fateful decision-making. And let me define for you what fateful decision-making is, student, because they have absolutely no idea what I'm talking about. Fateful decision-making is when your commander-in-chief, your president, sends young men and young women to die for state purposes, and something we quite often forget, to kill other people for state purposes. Either openly in war, hostilities we like to call them today in the great euphemism of the time, or in covert operations. And they look at me and, you know, what's a covert operation? Well, a covert operation is like the 59 that occurred in the 8 years of Ronald Reagan's administration, 50 of which you don't even know anything about. You were the taxpayer funding those operations. You are the American citizen those operations are supposedly conducted in the name of and for the security of, and yet you don't know a thing about them. And I submit to you that even with moratorium on classified information being lifted in 25 to 30 years, you probably never will. These are the kinds of things that happen in the Congo. These are the kinds of things that happen in the Middle East. These are the kinds of things that happen in Latin America. You never know anything about, but as Chalmers Johnson so eloquently said, sometimes they have vicious blowback. And you don't even know why the blowback is whistling through your ears because of what the CIA did in your name in a certain place. By the way, the 1947 Act did not contemplate the CIA being a covert action force. Nowhere in that act will you find a blessing institutionally, legally, statutorily for the CIA doing covert operations. Men, basically men at this time, like Alan Dulles, William O'Donovan, and others, flowed into that ambiguity in the act and created this arm of the CIA, which by the time we get to the Church and the Pike committees in the 70s, is assassinating world leaders, bringing down governments that are democratically elected, and so forth and so on. So this is a vicious institution that we've created, that like John Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs said, I would agree with, I would obliterate it if I could. I would get rid of it. Not necessarily its intelligence arm. The National Security Council, the president, needs strategic intelligence, but I'd darn sure get rid of the covert ops arm. But that's what it's all about. And by the way, that arm is what is doing a lot of the drone strikes today, because you want the CIA to do it rather than the military, because the military gets contaminated by doing these sorts of things. So you let the CIA do it. The mixture that's occurring right now with the military and the CIA beginning because of lack of resources to do it together is dangerous even in and of itself. But that's beside the point. I'm talking about institutions. What did the NSC do? The NSC stripped the cabinet, which was a very important, even from the very beginning with Washington and Adams, Jefferson and so forth, strip the cabinet of its power so you don't have distributed power across the institutional fabric of your government today. What you have is the White House. What you have is the NSC and the staff. Anyone from the State Department who will tell you the truth, anyone from any of the government agencies who will tell you the truth, or departments, will tell you that the decisions are made in the White House by an ever, ever decreasing number of people, except in the respect of their staffs. Let me give you an idea. Eisenhower's National Security Council staff was about 40 at its highest. George W. Bush and Dick Cheney's combined staff, yes, they both had staffs. Who was president? I'll let you guess. Numbered about 450. President Obama's NSC staff, that is to say just the president's, not counting Vice President Biden's, is the largest in the history of the republic. It's over 400 people. That's where the decisions are made, by an ever-decreasing group of people in terms of the bureaucracy at large, and that's where the power is. To give you an example, when the Chinese ambassador comes to visit the United States, he doesn't go see the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and the Pacific, or the Deputy Secretary of State, or even the Secretary of State, except on a secondary basis. He goes to see the Senior Director for Asia on the staff of the National Security Council. They know where the power is in this country. They also know that because of the bifurcation of that power, at least in terms of bureaucratics, they can play the cabinet against the NSC staff, against the Pentagon, and so forth and so on. I mean, so they know, Chinese in particular are very good at this, that they can come to Washington and get three or four different views. And is that confusing for them? Yes, it's confusing for them, but is it manipulatable by them? You bet it is. They can go back and say, well, I got this view from the Pentagon, I got this view from the White House, I got this view from the State Department, which shall we take as the view? And whichever one is most opportunistically advantageous for them, they take. And they parrot it back to us when they need to. This is an institutional nightmare. But it is a part of the warp and woof of the national security state, and a reason why the president himself can get away with making decision after decision after decision for what has become interminable warfare. Starts with Harry Truman when he blocks the North Korean invasion of Korea in the summer of 1950 and does not go to the Congress of the United States. And it ends, if you will, with what we're doing today. Most egregiously, what we did in Libya in 2011, where the president didn't even go to the Congress on the phone. Didn't say a word to the Congress. And then when he was caught out, tried to say, well, you know, it's really NATO and bombing is not really war. Try to tell the people the bombs are falling on. This is an institutional problem of the first order. That is to say, it is designed for war. It is designed for the military-industrial complex. It is designed for all the people who feed off war, to include the financiers of war. And let's just say something about these financiers. Go back and look at history. What the financiers do, whether they're Rothschilds or Sheldon Adelsons, is they have no nationality. They suck the empire dry of money and then switch ships. They go somewhere else. They can always find refuge when you're a multi-billionaire. Think about that for a minute. Spending $100,000 is like you dropping a dime. They can go anywhere, but they fund warfare, and they're doing it in this country. Look at Sheldon Adelson. He bought a newspaper in Israel, which has now become the mouthpiece for Bibi Netanyahu. Bibi Netanyahu's philosophy is, I want Jordan, I want the West Bank, I want Jerusalem as my capital, I want Gaza, and I covet Syria. That's Bibi Netanyahu. He is a Zionist par excellence. And we are in his back pocket. He gets 26 standing ovations in the Congress of the United States. Prime Minister Abe from Japan, who will address a joint session of Congress on the 29th of April, I dare say might get one. And he is 10 times, no, he's 100 times, more important ally for the United States economically, militarily, security-wise, whatever you want to say, than is Bibi Netanyahu, who is a liability for the United States. And yet Bibi gets 26 standing ovations. Tell me how that happens. Well, part of it is Sheldon Adelson. He bought this newspaper and then gave it away. Guess what? It has the highest circulation in Israel now. And it's a mouthpiece for Bibi. He's buying other newspapers now. I was on the Hill recently, and I was there to talk with Republicans. Yes, I'm a Republican. You can tell by the tie. I was there to talk to Republicans about the ongoing negotiations, about the stupid, idiotic, unwise letter from that not fresh behind the ears senator from Arkansas, Tom Cotton, with 46 other Republicans signing it. They went to the Ayatollah to tell him that the president of the United States was a black man and really didn't know what he was talking about. I mean, that's what the letter really was saying. And I'm on the Hill and I'm watching this guy. I'm watching Sheldon Adelson, this billionaire who made his billions, by the way, from Chinese, the Macau Island casinos, which are off the coast of China. He's shuttling between the Senate and the House. And he's fighting what I'm doing. He's essentially spending his billions to make sure that we go to war with Iran. Because he thinks the only way we keep Iran from a nuclear weapon is to go to war with them. And I'm saying, of course, that's the way to make them get a nuclear weapon. And also to put 500,000 troops into Iran, go there 10 years, 75 million people, very cohesive. We'll make them more cohesive. And at the end of those 10 years of invasion and occupation, as Tony Zinni, former commander of Central Command, said, if you liked Iraq, you'll love Iran. Because that'll be another $2 trillion, another 10 years, hundreds of thousands of casualties. And you won't have done anything at the end of that 10 years except put a red bullseye on the back of every American within 10,000 miles. Insanity. And yet, this system I've just described to you in just just small detail, is what's doing this to us in addition to the acquiescence of the American people in its happening. Now, in New Hampshire, I kept saying this to World Affairs Councils, to different groups. We met in one Unitarian church, and we talked to the congregation of the church and so forth. And people kept asking me during the Q&A, what do we do? What do we do? And, you know, my response was, I have no idea what you do in New Hampshire because I don't live here, and I don't know your politics, and I don't know how to operate in your state. But let me tell you something. You got to do something because nobody in Washington is going to do it. I guarantee you. There is too much investment in this whole process. There is too much serious money being made in this whole process. Why do we not do anything really of consequence about the drug war? There is too much money being made by people in the drug war. Far too much money. By the banks who are laundering the money. By the people who are selling arms to the drug dealers in Mexico and so forth. We're the largest arms seller in the world by a margin that dwarfs the Soviet Union so badly, Russia now, that it's almost 2-1. We're the world's merchants of death. Don't you think for a moment that the National Rifle Association cares about my ability to pack a weapon or go hunting? I'm insignificant to the NRA. The reason the NRA is in existence is to shill for the people who make the bigger arms that we sell all over the world to the tune of $88 billion in the high year in the last five. Think about that. $88 billion. Why did Putin decide that he needed to move in Georgia and in Ukraine? Because we were operating as if he were operating in Cuba and Nicaragua. We were in his near abroad. We were in his area of influence, sphere of influence is the phrase we academics use. Not only were we in it, we were sticking our fingers in his face. We were selling missile defense after having abrogated the anti-ballistic missile treaty, my administration. We were selling missile defense to places like Poland and elsewhere and saying, oh, this is defend against Iran. You know, Putin says, yeah, right. Yeah, I understand that. There's absolutely no question about why Putin moved in Georgia and why he moved in Ukraine. It also boosted his poll ratings in Moscow, of course, because now we've made the Russians hate our guts. It is the biggest factor in Putin's domestic popularity that he's standing up to the United States of America. It's keeping him in power. Our actions are keeping him in power. But why did we do that so much? This is Bill Clinton. He's a Democrat. Well, Bill Clinton wanted to appease Lockheed Martin and others who salivated over selling arms to the newly freed portions of the Soviet Union, like Poland and Czech Republic, Hungary, and so forth. This is a huge conglomerate, as Eisenhower suggested, that has now found out how institutionalized this process is in Washington and doesn't have a whole range of people it has to influence, certainly not the American people, except indirectly about jobs sometimes, it only has to get in there and influence one or two people. That's all it has to do. It's kind of like our elections process. You know, we did a study at William & Mary and found that most elections in America feature less than 10% of the eligible voters actually going and dropping a ballot. Think about that for a minute. All you do is buy 5.5% of the electorate, and Sheldon Adelson could do that without even writing many checks, and you've got the election. It's not much better as you move up into gubernatorial races and as you move into more national races like the Senate and the House, and as we saw this last time, or let's just look at the statistic since World War II. We have rarely elected a president of the United States with more than 26 or 27% of the vote. Well, we rail at other countries that have different systems than ours because those systems produce multi-party systems, for example, that is to say more than two. Those systems produce a leader who might not get but a third of the vote or 40% of the vote. We haven't had anybody in the White House who got more than 26 or 27% of the vote since 1950. Think about that for a second. That's colossal apathy, which has had a part to play in this process I'm talking about. The institutional fabric is there, the apathy is there, and so we have more war. Is it any surprise that we're at war now for 14 years and I see no end? I see no end at all. I was talking to the, I guess I can say this, she wouldn't mind. I'm talking to the senator from Maine, she, you know who that is. I had arranged a telephone call with her to tell her that I appreciated, and I'd written an op-ed in the Huffington Post about the Magnificent Seven, the seven Republicans who didn't sign Tom Cotton's letter. Lamar Alexander, Susan Collins, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and so forth. And I get her on the phone. She says, I'll talk to you. So I get her on the phone, and we're talking, and I said, you know, you need to do something about the Republican Party's ability to derail the present negotiations with Iran. She said, what's your concern? I said, my concern is that we're going to go to war. We're going to go to war with Iran, another war in Southwest Asia, another war in the Middle East, another war that is going to end the Empire of Liberty. The good part and the bad part. And from what we've heard here this morning, we probably all would cheer. I would join you if we ended the bad part, the warmongering, war-making part. But we're going to end the good part, too. That's my grave concern. We're going to end the good part, too. The history of empire is not replete with those who did demise well. You know, I asked my students, where is the granite stone on which engraved are the words, the American empire is forever? And they look at me, I don't know where that stone is. Well, there is no such stone. And 5,000 years of human history says the American empire is no different from any previous empire, except in that respect. No other empire would ever make that claim, not even the British. There are several ways for this empire to go, and because of that aspect of it, it makes me gravely concerned. One is, like most have, disappear. There's every prospect of that. The second is that it morphs like Rome did. It relocates. It adapts a religion. You know, it has a special set of circumstances. It can go from Rome to Constantinople. It can say it's Catholic. And it can suddenly have a new frame of reference for its empire and last another 400 years. Or it can do like Britain did and become a middling power, as one British diplomat recently said to me, Jeremy Greenstock. We're a middling power, you know, Larry. I said, yeah, I know that. How do you step down from being that bad side of empire, the warmongering, war-making empire, down to not a middling empire, but an empire that embraces what the original founders thought about, didn't do too well, but thought about at least, tried to codify, what they thought was an empire of liberty. How do you not lose that, but lose the bad part? That's the huge question. Now, I just wrote an op-ed for the Global Times in China. Zhu Liyun, the managing editor, sent me an email and he said, you know, you've wrote a lot of op-eds for us here in China, and we've given you a lot of liberty, he said. The Chinese term is a little different, but we've given you a lot of leeway, is a better translation, in terms of our editing. Because as you probably are aware, China doesn't like just anything to go into its newspapers, especially the Global Times. So I said, okay, you'll give me the right to look at your translation and your editing of my op-ed. Yes. So he sent it back to me last night in the Hilton here on the University of Houston campus. And it was he didn't do a bad job. He didn't do a bad job. And in that, I go through what I've just went through with you, but in 800 words or less. I mean, I try to say what's happening to the United States, because the question he asked me to address was, why does America use the war instrument so much? This is coming from a Chinese gentleman. At the end, the last three paragraphs, I said, here's why this empire could take advantage of the current circumstances in the world if it were smart and had the right leadership, and if China helped. Here's how things could be very different. We have the biggest challenge coming at us the human race has ever confronted. Go back and look at the history we know about, and that's quite a statement. This thing called planetary climate change is going to eat our lunch. It is going to absolutely eat our lunch. Whether you believe the small side, the big side, or somewhere in the middle. It is going to mean that the 1,000 years we've just lived through, which have been, by any scientists or layman who studies it estimate, the best 1,000 years for human life on this planet. That is to say, we've gone from being a just tiny little bunch of people to being, by 2050, 9 billion. We've done that because agriculture, water, and other aspects of human life have been very conducive to that life. That is getting ready to change with a vengeance. And whether we're contributing or not is irrelevant, except in one respect. It is going to happen, period. Any geologist, any climatologist will tell you it's going to happen. The question is, are we accelerating it? And if we are, can we slow that acceleration down by changing our behavior? That's really what this question is all about. And when I'm looking at a congressman 2 weeks ago who looks at me and says, when I say the 4.5 billion year old Earth, and he says, oh no, stop there. The Earth is 6,248 years old. I know that because of Genesis. I know the nature of the challenge. The lead federal bureaucracy in Washington right now on climate change is the United States Navy, because they know what's coming. They know how many disaster assistance, humanitarian relief, and other missions they're going to have to perform, like the tsunami in Indonesia in 2005, like the Daiichi Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. They know these are going to come every 10 years instead of every 100 years, and it's because of climate change. So the Navy is desperately trying to get its act together so it can do a better job of humanitarian assistance and relief. The Congress is trying at every step of the way to thwart the Navy from doing it, whether it's changing their energy sources or whether it's appropriating the money for this, the Congress is trying to thwart them. So that's the situation we're in vis-a-vis this most incredible challenge, probably the most incredible challenge we've ever confronted. So you see the coincidence here, I think. And what I was saying in my op-ed, I hope will run in China, is that if China and the United States, and then, of course, Germany and others follow, lead 20, say, the G20, and then the others that have to follow, we can meet this challenge. And at the same time we're meeting that challenge, we can change this focus, alter this focus that we have on warmongering, because it isn't going to work. It simply isn't going to work to solve these problems. You cannot aim your M16 at climate change. You can't even aim your B-2 bombers and your F-35s at climate change. Climate change is going to do it to all of us. The most positive prediction that I have seen by 2070, that's my grandchildren's lifetime probably, is 400 million people left on this planet. Because that's all the water, agriculture, and so forth will support after this change begins to be noticed a little more substantially than now. And don't think it's not already being noted. You'll like this. Langley Air Force Base has problems taking off its jets even now. Norfolk, where I live, the largest East Coast naval installation, is looking at the Dutch at $4 to $5 billion of water abatement, $4 to $5 billion of water abatement construction, because water is becoming untenable for that area. Look at the National Geographic magazine. Look at Miami, what's going to happen to Miami by 2030. The streets are going to be flooded. We get a Category 4 right up the channel of the Hudson, and Wall Street will be 10 feet underwater. Yeah, it'd be good. I'd go for that, too. You know, we military types used to have a joke. It was with regard to war with the Soviet Union. We hoped the first nuclear weapon fell on the Pentagon because we knew then we'd be free to, you know, do what we needed to do. That was serious. I mean, we were serious about that. That's how much we felt Washington had become a part of the problem and not a part of the solution. So this is not just what you've been briefed on earlier, all of which I pretty much agree with. And I'm a 31-year veteran of the United States military up here telling you that. It's in our blood. It's in our institutional blood. It's been designed to be this way. And there are lots of very wealthy people who want to keep it that way. 400 Americans combined have the wealth of the gross domestic product of Brazil. It's not the 1% that's dominating us. It's the 0.001%. If you're Aristotelian or Platonic, you know oligarchy, plutocracy. This is the world's greatest quintessential plutocracy. It is running us all, and it is running the empire of liberty, that good aspect, that good potential of the United States of America, off the cliff. Thank you.